Hello, everybody, and welcome to our first virtual Frameworks event. We're going to have Lori Leroy from BioCrossroads kick us off. And just wanted to let everyone know all the attendees are on mute. So we would like for you to use the Q&A tool on the webinar to send any questions to the panelists. We'll do our best to get to answers today. And if not, we will definitely address them and get them out to the group once the webinar is over. And with that, I'll pass it off to Lori Leroy, Vice President at BioCrossroads.
Welcome, everyone, and good morning. Glad you could join us for our first virtual Frameworks. We're really excited to bring this content to you today. And hopefully you can eat your lunch and learn some really great information about work that's happening here in Indiana. First of all, I want to welcome everybody and thank our sponsors, Indy Science Connect and the Indiana Biosciences Research Institute. Today, we're talking to you about the impact that COVID-19 has had on point-of-care diagnostics. To say our lives have been completely disrupted is an understatement. COVID-19 has changed the way we work, live, and play. It's also changing the way that we conduct research and development, and especially with new technologies. Point-of-care testing has become significantly more sophisticated over the years, meeting clinical needs for quick and accurate test results where it's needed and when it's needed, as we all know all too well right now. But having available and accurate testing in minutes isn't enough. We have to be able to test the masses and test them quickly. Point-of-care testing has never been more important than it is today, and the entire world is now watching and waiting to see how the industry responds. So with that, I would like to introduce our first speaker, Dr. Michael Puja, investigator and director of bioanalytical technologies at the Indiana Biosciences Research Institute. Dr. Puja works to develop new single-cell bioanalytical technology for measuring proteomic biomarkers as targeted diagnostics for the fields of endocrinology, oncology, and infectious disease. Michael has spent 30 years in the biomedical in vitro diagnostic industry for Bayer and then for Siemens Diagnostics Divisions. So please welcome him, and we look forward to hearing what he has to say today.
Okay, so thank you. Hopefully I can advance the slide. There we go. Okay. Wrong way. Sorry. Okay, so I'm just going to jump into the presentation a little bit. I guess it sort of overcorrects a little bit. So really, point of care technology, you know, got its start in Indiana. And I don't think a lot of people really know that the urine test strips and the first glucose test strips were invented here in the late 40s and 50s. And they had pretty much evolved to a mature product line by the 80s. A lot of this work was led by Alan Helen Free. And in the 80s, there was really a paradigm change to go from optical dipsticks to electrochemical sensors. And today, those are still, you know, manufactured here by Roche. These companies, you know, developed the idea of a glucose meter. I mean, they actually coined glucose meters and the word strips. So when I left, or when I started here in my career in the late 80s, point of care testing was still, you know, pretty hot topic. But, you know, it really stalled in the 90s. And really it was due to a much needed regulation of the whole field, which was the CLIA Act. And then the cost of capital to bring in high volume manufacturing really stalled it a lot. But really, I think the final nail on the coffin has been the cost that it really takes to validate and verify a clinical diagnostic marker. I mean, few people know that, you know, literally maybe one test a year, one new marker a year makes it to market. But with that said, I was, you know, able to be exposed to, you know, the leading edge people who were at a company called Miles or Ames Division at the time. And one of those was Dr. Lowry Messenger. And he really developed a state-of-the-art test called the Diabetes Care Analyzer. It was able to really set up a standard of quantitation for a point-of-care immunoassay. Fortunately, he picked a really good one to do, which was hemoglobin A1C, and they brought that to the market, just one test. And now that's sort of an everyday word for everybody who's a diabetic. They know what hemoglobin A1C is, but it's a real challenge to bring something like that to market. And it was really a tribute to that team to do that. At the same time, I was on another team led by Dr. David Ledin, who thought, well, you know, measuring one thing isn't going to work. We need to measure many things. So they took the pregnancy testing concept, which had just been developed, immunochromatography, and brought that to a strip reader and developed the whole concept of optical imaging. Long before we had cell phones and even CCD cameras. And that, you know, one of the markets that they focused on obviously was, you know, infectious disease, the flu test. You know, these technologies had limitations. They were yes, no test. And really, you know, a lot of point of care devices have not really helped this whole thing. They're, you know, a lot of times they lack cost effectiveness. So it's just easier to get an accurate answer from the lab the next day. And rarely do they both achieve a high clinical sensitivity and a high clinical specificity. So somehow this concept of allowing, you know, 50% false positive rate or a 50% false negative rate became acceptable. And it's really caused a lot of issues. One of the biggest issues it causes is antimicrobial resistance. So in the 2000s, actually at 2000, you know, I was privileged to be on some really leading edge lab on a chip teams. One led by with a company called MicroParts, Gert Blankenstein, you know, was doing the first microfluidic designs for lab on the chip. And then later with Dr. Walter Gumbrich, who had literally, you know, fathered the lab on the chip design. This shows those devices. And, you know, we really had the hope that miniaturization and taking these designs was going to allow us to, you know, reach more markets, more assays and stuff like that. The issue is we ran into a lot of laws of nature that we hadn't considered, and the cost was really, the cost of even the device and of validation and capital were just enormous to do a technology change. In the 2010s, a lot of the microfluidic technologies did survive. I was on a project with Walter Gumbrich where we were able to take them into the central laboratory and do more sophisticated tests that, you know, you would charge more money for. And one of those was circulating tumor cells, where we were able to, you know, isolate a handful of cells out of a tube of blood and determine if you still had circulating cancer cells during metastatic cancer. The issue with that is, you know, it takes 3 or 4 days. It's only done in a lab. Only a very small number of people get those kinds of tests. They're very helpful for directing chemotherapy. At the same time, our interest in industry started to tend towards mass spectrometry. And I don't know if few people probably know that, you know, Indiana is the epicenter of analytical chemistry, like the leading state for analytical chemistry. And one of those key fields is mass spectrometry. And these guys work together well across all the universities. They recently formed the National Science Foundation center called the Center for Biometrology, where they're collaborating in this space with industry. One of the key people in the field who, you know, literally fathered mass spectrometry is named Graham Parks, and he had invented at Purdue a miniature mass spectrometer. So we thought, well, maybe we could try that to try to get to a point of care device. Again, a very high tech approach to try to achieve it. At about that point, I became you know, a little frustrated with the industrial approach. I mean, Zoom meetings and industrial collaboration, you know, we've been doing this for like 20 years, you know, all of our teams are all over the place. You know, we thought, well, why don't we just try to focus it a little bit more on a collaborative model where we had more boots on the ground in more places where we could actually do more hands-on work and try a collaborative model across the ecosystem of Indiana by taking industrial scientists and putting them into the Indiana Biosciences Research Institute and seeing if we could try some collaborative models. So this project that I'm going to share here and some of the speakers today are part of that team effort. And this was the approach that we took, which was really not to start with technology, but to start with customer needs. And we did that with a very cool market analysis system out of Notre Dame in the Mendoza School of Business, which was the STEAM program. And they basically take a really smart student and they give them access to all these really cool Notre Dame alumni, many of them who are doctors, and get to ask them a series of questions and keep peeling back the onion until you can get to the real heart of what the design needs to be. Once we had that idea, you know, all the universities really need to have these core high-tech facilities. And the one that we were working with to get the initial core technology done is the NanoFab facility that Dr. Patrick Fay has at Notre Dame. And, you know, so we can make some of these sensor concepts to try to address the market need. He rightly, you know, directed us to a technology provider, which is Indiana Integrated Circuits. It's a startup up in the Notre Dame ecospace. And Mr. Jason Kulik is an electrical engineer who, you know, got his degree at Notre Dame and decided to become a technology provider. And by that, it's somebody who helps do the tech transfer, take the design out of the NanoFab facility and get it into the hands of people who are going to license it. And he's extremely gifted at doing that. So once you have the core technology, you still need to create a device around it. So it wasn't too hard to find one of the leaders in BioMEMS, which is another term for microfluidic integration, Professor Weirley. And we did a collaborative project with his PhD candidate student, KZ Gupta, and simplified the design from a big giant robot to a little handheld. So that's more of how the device works, but to really get it to work right, you need really sound analytical chemistry direction. Especially in this domain, it was in electrochemistry, so we didn't have too far to look to find Frederic in analytical chemistry, an up-and-coming professor at IUPUI, and she was very, very gracious in sharing two undergraduate students that became a fixture, and to help really direct some of the industrial postdocs that we had, which really needed more of a professor's touch. So even with that, if you get all that done, you still need access to the medical school. And we were blessed. The application that we set out to do was pathogens that were resistant, bio threats. You know, we weren't thinking about COVID. There are actually worse ones out there. We were thinking about bacteria, film-forming bacteria. And fortunately, you know, Professor Sen and Dr. Roy at the IU School of Medicine in the Department of Surgery are like the world's experts in this field. And they could get us straight on what we needed to do to test to get us these early samples. And also, at the same time, we have a great, you know, pathology department with key opinion leaders. Gerald Denny's is one of those in microbiology and gave us access to samples for testing. So that's a long-winded description of how it worked. Hopefully I'm not too far off track on time. So once what the team tried to do was change the paradigm. And a lot of this is just direction that you get from grants, from the NIH, stuff like that. They want to be able to take a complex sample, a milliliter, and process it immediately. And, you know, isolate anywhere from down to about 10 pathogens. I say virus here, but any kind of pathogen, and be able to detect and enumerate them and quantitate them. And to do that in anywhere from 1 to 30 minutes, and to do that in a highly multiplex panel. The panel concept that we did was 341 results. And it would process anything, any kind of complex sample, blood, urine, you know, so you don't have to keep changing it. And it'll do a microliter up to a milliliter. So, but the concept that really came across was, you know, let's not have to get another sample. Let's take that sample after it's tested and send it to the laboratory to be confirmed with even a higher multiplexing biomarker platform that's much faster than what's out there. And that, of course, is the mass spectrometry, which you know, came out of the collaboration with Professor Cooks on a technology called Sierra technology. And that really allows 28,000 results in a day, which is an order of magnitude greater than the current platforms. At the same time, we knew that it was essential to preserve the genetic information, so the same sample can have the genetic information. And as long as we were capturing the cells, we wanted to show that we could clean the cells and release their DNA and RNA, and be able to just use regular PCR to identify the actual mutations in the pathogens. And so I'm happy to say this is, you know, pretty much a, you know, been all written up in a paper. Just to look at the technology, core technology, a little bit closer, this is the actual sensor. It's the size of an ELISA well. It has 341 micro wells in it. Each micro well is a separate sensor. At the bottom of it, it has a slotted great electrode that allows capture of only what we want to detect and passing away all the other interferences. Sort of the magic of Jason's design was to put a little electrode in each one. And one of the easy benefits was to show that we could self-array individual capture beads easily during manufacturing into all these wells, so that we could get 341 addressable answers. And not really, once that's done, the mass spec reagents can be just released with a simple acid, and then they're run on the mass spectrometry, or we can lyse the captured cells and do their DNA and RNA. So it all comes down to laws of nature and not trying to break laws of nature. So there's really three working principles of any kind of, you know, complex point of care system. One is isolation. So you're starting with a complex sample and you want to get it down to just the rare molecules that matter and into a small space rather quickly. This comes down to things like porosity, materials, pore sizes, stuff like that. The other thing you want to do is you want to be super sensitive, more sensitive than anything that's out there. Currently, immunoassays have a sensitivity floor of about 0.1 nanomolar. Sometimes they can get a little bit deeper into the picomolar. But by using the microwells, we're able to concentrate all that signal into a smaller volume, and that's allowed us to hit 6.6 femtomolar is what the last test result showed. So that means that that's significantly more sensitive than what is out in the laboratory right now. And that allows us to use less samples, less costly reagents, or to detect things a lot earlier. At the same time, multiplexing is key. I mean, we all know that, you know, multiple sources of data just make it a lot better. So we wanted to keep optical, which we managed to. We wanted to use spatial, which is microwells, like I showed, 341 microwells. And then we wanted to go to barcoding, which is a concept, mass label concept that was developed that allows really unlimited, each antibody can have a different barcode. We weren't really working on COVID. It wasn't one of the key pathogens to worry about in February. I mean, we were aware of it, but today we're working on it. And so I think COVID is a good example of trying to get actionable information quickly. So there's really a couple of different things that need to be measured at the same time. One is, you know, do we have live virus? Do you have dead virus? And the more sensitive you are, you know, the further down in the incubation window you can detect. So if you can get closer to 0 days, you're able to contain people quicker, right? So, and if you can do that within a few minutes, you know that those people have an issue and that they could be properly treated. That's called actionable information. So with, you know, 6,000 point of care systems, you should be able to screen 1 million people in a day and still be able to take the collected virus and send it to the pathology department to do a deeper dive. It, maybe the resistance has changed, maybe it's mutated. The other thing that really is needed is to tell how a person's immune system is reacting. And the immune system really reacts in about 7 days by producing a molecule called IgM. So you have to be able to detect that first. That IgM response goes down in about 21 days, and then our more permanent response, which is our antibodies called IgG, are there. So you can see that you need a multiplex of different results to really gauge where a patient is in the work process. And we need to think beyond just one particular virus, right? This might be, you know, we want to be able to detect more than just one thing at a time. We also would like to know how the patient is responding in his immune system. People have different abilities to respond to infection. So that is everything I had to share. I'm going to try to get this to the right thing here. Oh yeah, I'm definitely going in the wrong direction now. Okay, almost. One more, please. There we go, okay. So I'd like to introduce Professor Frederique Dice. She's an assistant professor at IUPUI School of Science. As I mentioned, analytical chemistry is an essential element behind diagnostics. And Indiana is a leader in this science, and it teams up well. And I was privileged to be teamed up with Frederique.
Thank you, Michael, for this introduction. So as I mentioned, I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Chemistry and Chemical Biology at the Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, IUPUI. And so what we are doing in my group for like the last few years is to try to develop electrochemical bioanalytical tools. And so we do that in particular using paper microfluidic spectroscopy. So what that means is like, in addition of like kind of advancing the fundamentals of chemistry, like you will typically do in a department of chemistry, we are also trying to do applied research, meaning actually having projects which will answer a societal question. So any type of challenges that have been identified and trying to specifically find a new way, a better way if possible, or alternative way to answer it. And so in particular, we do this with electrochemical analysis because, well, electrochemistry is known to be sensitive, selective, and quantitative, and allow like nice analytical detection. But so what we also do in our system is we are trying to develop tools that will be specifically for in-field and point-of-care application. And when we do that, we don't only focus on the chemistry, but we also focus on the sampling. How will we collect the sample? How will we transport the sample? How will it be stored? And all these different aspects which go around making a point-of-care devices. And so our application will go to preventive care, diagnostic, environmental monitoring, and also forensic. And So today I will try to show you a few projects that we have ongoing in the lab and try to highlight some of these particular aspects in each of these examples. And so you can kind of see in the slide scattered all around multiple paper-based devices. And so I will say 2/3 of our project are actually using paper as a substrate to make low-cost, portable, versatile point-of-care devices. So the first project I would like to introduce to you is something we are doing for oral preventive care. And the idea is that you can actually know if someone has chances to develop a cavities before they have a cavities by looking at the pH of the plaque on the bacteria, the saliva around the mouth. So if you're below a critical pH of 5.5, so typically you can begin to know that the bacteria responsible of cavities will be very happy, and they will also maintain this very low pH to begin to start the erosion of the enamel of the teeth and to form a cavities. And so what we want to do is we want to make a little like paper-based device like you can see here, and that's like, because they are so portable, I could bring with me in my home. So you can actually have them and be able to measure the pH at different positions in the mouth to do it, but having no chemicals on it, because who would like to kind of put a bunch of like pH paper or chemicals in your mouth when you're testing it? So the idea is to actually only use graphite, which is pretty much what you have in a pencil, minus actually the glue you have in a pencil, so it's safer than a pencil, putting into contact with the teeth and measure a pH. And so to do that chemical free, if we can say, what we are doing is we are relying on some oxo group like quinone, which are present just by reaction of graphite with the air. So if you have graphite, if it's in presence of air, you form this type of quinone group, and their redox activity is actually sensitive to pH. So depending on the pH, you will have different peak, and so you can see this type of peak here, which will kind of like shift depending on the pH, and then you can do some kind of calibration curve over multiple pH and such on. And so this is a project that we started, of course, like pretty much for 2 years in the lab doing solutions based and developing all these aspects, but then now we have moved to artificial saliva, and our next step is now to use real saliva and real bacteria biofilm responsible of cavities with our collaborator in the School of Dentistry of IU. And so another project we have staying with the bacteria detection is to try to have a system to detect bacteria at a very, very low limit of detection. Meaning our goal would be to really go down to one bacterium, because we know that even one bacterium can be lethal in some type of, in some pathogen disease. And so very often, the current method of detection will rely on some type of amplification or culture. And as Michael mentioned before, we have kind of like three patterns which we use for point of care diagnostic. And so two of them are like isolation and concentrating our signal. So what we are actually trying to do here is to be able to achieve this very low limit of detection. Instead of trying to increase the amount of bacteria, we're actually decreasing the volume by encapsulating our analytes into droplets. And so we are pretty much locally having a high concentration, not because you have more bacteria, but because you have a very small volume. And so we are currently developing in my lab, like all the kind of system, doing some very basic microfluidic device, like Steve Riley will show you something very, way fancier than what we do. We stay very basic because we are more focusing on the chemistry. But what is the impact, especially of this project, is we are doing what we call the reverse assay, which means that if we have no bacteria in our sample, so bacteria is this little pink thing. So if you have no bacteria in your sample, you will actually have light emitted, so you have a signal. But if the bacteria is present, you have no signal. And you might wonder, why can this be relevant when you're trying to do a low limit of detection? Well, this is all good when you're doing detection in solution that you have created. But if you go back to a real sample, you will have a lot of other species in what we call the matrix of a sample. So the other element present in sample, but what you're interested in. And these other elements might actually react. They might actually artificially increase your signal, creating false positive. They might decrease your signal, creating false negative, and such on. And so having a reverse system like this for this project actually allow us to have 90% of our droplets, which does not have a bacteria in it, to give us a baseline, which will take into account all these other elements present in your complex sample. And so this would also allow us to do it with a known sample, if we can call it, like a blood sample, when we typically know the interference, but also way more complex sample, like having food, beverages, soil, where you will have almost unknown interference that can mess up your reaction. And so having 90% of your signal, which is actually coming from all this interference, give you a way better baseline than if you're trying to do a standard before or do another reference before your system. So this is actually one of our current ongoing project, really focusing in being able to analyze complex samples when we don't know what is in it. And then I'm like now changing gear as an electrochemist. We like to detect ions, you know, ions, like all our redox chemistry kind of is coming from an ionic metal plus electron give you back the metal and such on. So it's kind of the bread and butter of electrochemist. And I'm sure a lot of people must have used ion selective electrode in a lot of different type of labs, which typically use potentiometry. We are actually developing new techniques which will use voltammetry and allow us to use our paper-based system in like a simplified probing system, which doesn't require to have a fragile probe and such on. And we started this project developing it for blood analysis, because actually your potassium level can help you assess the overall health of someone. It can also be very useful for disease like hypokalemia, where people cannot fix potassium and literally require their blood to be tested every week, every other week, kind of like diabetic patient, but for potassium. So trying to have a simple system like the glucose meter, but for potassium, because it's a disease which doesn't touch as many people as diabetes, well, you don't have currently a disposable portable system to do it at home. So people need to get measured in a lab every week or so. But when we developed this this project, what was very interesting for me is to realize that I had people coming from all different areas of science and telling me, oh, this could be very useful for what we work on. So for example, a collaborator in the School of Medicine, Department of Pathology, for the forensic aspect, told me that measuring the potassium level in the vitreous humor, the liquid behind the eye, can actually be useful to estimate the time of death. And so he actually has many hundreds of samples ready. So when our test is ready, we have like liquid of dead people, so we can measure some real sample for this. People are beginning to tell me how this is so useful for water quality, that actually people, when they, in industry, when they do bottled water, they do test for potassium to have an overall idea of the quality of their water. It's also very important for agriculture and soil analysis, because it can give you information on the overall assessment of the soil at a particular environment. So having a portable device to do it, which would be even degradable with paper, could be very useful. And then it actually circled back to the food, because potassium in one of the micronutrients or electrolytes that you can actually ingest to kind of balance your nutrition. So you actually need to know how much you have in food to know how much food you should eat to kind of bring your potassium level back to where it should be. So what I wanted to show you with this particular example is that if in our lab in chemistry, we start with one particular project and we have a certain like characteristic, we are developing it for blood, certain range of concentration, we can after adapt it to many other applications in different fields. But for this, we need to actually have the collaborator who can let us know that this will allow us to, sorry, I read a question at the same time. We need to actually have the collaborator to let us know where the need is. And so, this is actually very important. And I think this is also what happened here with COVID-19. We see so many researchers, they started their work, maybe they were working on coronavirus, another one, or they were working on point of care testing of virus, and they were able to shift and adapt very quickly by talking to the right people and knowing the new characteristic to transform maybe a device down 90% for something else to something which now could be useful for COVID-19. And this is so important in our research system. And so now another project I would like to go to is kind of on the other side of the field, and not so much for the diagnostic for the health of patients, but actually for forensic applications. So we have currently some federal funding for the National Institute of Justice to be able to detect an oxidizer used in IEDs, which is chlorate. So fertilizer was used a lot before, but now fertilizer is so controlled that bad people kind of shifted a lot to chlorate. Sometimes up to 80% of bomb, for example, in Afghans were actually done with chlorate. And so we are trying to have a system which will allow you to screen quickly in the field the system. But here again, we see the whole importance to know what kind of sample you will want to make your device for. Because you see here where it's a collaboration of the Indiana State Police and the Good Pastor Lab in IUPUI for the forensic program, we were able to explode our own bombs. So the police did that. But so we actually had like a pipe bomb, for example, made of metal here. You would need in such a sample to be able to swipe your device against such a metal to be able to test it. But we also made some bomb with plastic pipes. And I cannot show a picture for you because this was pulverized, which actually means that like all the plastic is in small pieces, which are pretty much mixed with all the little stones of the quarry we did our explosion. So that means that for this type of sample, we actually collected soil, which has no metal piece of plastic. And so we need our device to be able to collect sample in multiple type of systems. So our solution when we do it in lab or after swiping system or like collecting powder. So for example, with our paper-based device, we had to come up with solution to see and test to see if we impregnate our device with certain volume of liquid, how will we be able to swipe the powder and then being able to see our electrochemical signal from that. And I mentioned earlier, so storage and transport can also be important. It's particularly important for forensic because let's be clear, my device can be useful for screening, but they will take a long time that they can be used in court and you can actually, you know, convict someone of us saying, oh yes, we think you made a bomb here. And so here's the idea is we need to be able to collect our sample, do a quick screening in field, and then bring it to a state lab for confirmatory test. And so here's the idea was to actually use similar type of system like tape and paper and encase our whole system in something which will allow it to be fully closed, store our sample, transport it to the state lab and house there the ion detection that are like the gold standard for like the chloride detection. And those have all the proof, both the screening and the confirmatory proof that can be used there further. And so this actually brings us to the project that Michael already presented a little bit to you that we collaborated on. So we presented you some of the aspects of like the engineering behind, and I will talk to you a bit more about the chemistry that we did here, and also how relevant it was to understand how we can mix multiple devices. So as we said here for this particular project, we're trying to use a Sierra technology and being able to detect some bacteria without any culture and being able to, in particular, identify if it would be a gram-positive, gram-negative, and then being also able to get right away the DNA RNA to then know if we have any type of, like, so what will be the responsibility for the antimicrobial resistance genes. So what we want to do here, if you think about it, is an electrochemical assay, a mass spectrometric assay, and in the same time, we want to collect this in a membrane to do microfluidics to kind of have all the sampling happening, and then lyse our bacterial cell, which was detected, and be able to collect the DNA. So this is actually multiple steps with multiple type of reagent, different type of volume, different type of sensing device, and we wanted to mix all this. Why do we want to mix all this? Well, because electrochemistry in this case can give us very quickly a screening test to just know, is this bacteria present? And just by detecting this with an enzymatic reaction, so kind of like an ELISA type, but done by electrochemistry, we can detect the formation of a product and know that like the bacteria were there. Then the mass spectrometry will kind of give us some type of barcoding and using a realizable mass label agent, as Michael described before, we'll be able to actually know more about what bacteria was present as well and have like already a confirmatory test about what's going on. Might take a little bit more time our screening, but it's still very, very fast. As you mentioned before, we can do 10,000, 28,000 samples per day. But then after that, you can actually do the DNA or RNA isolation. And what is important here is doing the test on DNA or RNA is way more time consuming and need more trained personnel. Whereas here, we'll only do it for the sample which are already positive. So this means that you're really helping the whole backlog of tests. And so when you begin to have a lot of people sick in the same time, as we are seeing now, having this kind of like cascade of a very fast screening test, a confirmation test pretty fast, and then a test which gives you all the information of the pathogen change and like the mutation, will actually really give you a lot of information without overusing your personnel. So this can be actually very important. And so here we needed a very, very big team to be able to develop all this project. So through all the collaboration Michael would describe before, and especially because we needed to make sure all our reagents are compatible. And so for this, we needed to hear from everybody, from the microfluidics point of view, for the chemist point of view, the mass label expert, the people from bacteria expert, to have all the experts together to know how we can make this work. And so today we do not have with us some collaborators, but I wanted to really highlight in particular Dr. Dennis from the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine, who is a key opinion leader for our industry in serving especially microbiology clinical laboratory, and who were able to give us some urine sample that was the key to make this project from a proof of concept to a real device, and also Dr. Sen and Dr. Roy in the Department of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine as well were key opinion leader for all the biofilm forming, and was very, very useful for us to make sure we can get this isolation and testing of our bacteria. And so I would like to finish on the next slide to thank all my students, because I can tell you that if the professor talking, all the students are always the one who do most of the work. And so in particular, I want to highlight Regina and Monica Baron, who are two undergraduate, who are in between my lab and Dr. Max Puglia team for like the last, 3 years. They are now moved to other endeavor, doing a PhD for one and a MD for the other one in IU School of Medicine. And also Dr. T. Ash Bose, who is a postdoctoral fellow in IBRI and also helped a lot my group. So we were really, these three people were the bridge between Michael's team and my team to be able to bring all our skills together. Because I knew a lot about the electrochemistry, but we needed all the information about the urine samples, the microfluidics, the mass label to make this work. And so this was very, very important to be a successful project here. Thank you to all of you for listening today.
So Frederica, I know from your talk here that, you know, you really get the value of having the end user direction, and whether that's clinical or other, and of using real world samples. But what I find confusing often when I do these programs is which end user to listen to, you know, and it just, do you have any advice for designers?
So, that's actually a very good point. And you saw, with one project I mentioned, we could have multiple direction. I will say I definitely have a specific direction when we're developing one project with one particular team when we're doing this. And using real sample is so important, because I think every researcher, especially the one developing device, they don't want to just like do science. They want to actually help people. They want to help save lives. They want to help the environment, the communities. And to do this, you cannot do it with just a little sample we create in the lab. We need to have the real sample with all the interference that we might have. As I mentioned, everything which could create fake positive, fake negative, and such on. And to get this, you need collaborators, you need to have a network of people, and I will say being able to interact with team like here with IBRI, this opened a lot of doors for me to have other collaborators that can then be useful for other projects. Making sure to have, as I mentioned, people who are really there. Like Michael and I was meeting once a week or every other week, but like the girls and Dr. Tiash Bose, they were there every day, and they were often in contact with both of us every day, and they were at meeting with all the other members of the team. And so they were able to really capture the characteristic and convey what are needed. So I think really being clear early on what will be the real sample, what will be the real target, and have a very clear characteristic set. You know, if we want to do urine, you have another volume that you're, if you're taking blood. If you're taking blood from a baby, you have way less volume that you would have if someone pee. So kind of having this is very important, both for the chemistry, for the concentration sample, for the microfluidics and such on. So being very clear of your characteristic and talk to the experts, because we are only expert in our own like zone, and we need the others and the collaboration to get there. And I would add that for me, being able to collaborate with a team like the Indiana Bioscience Research Institute team was very key. This project was like, you know, on steroids versus all my other projects. It went way faster, even if I didn't have a PhD student on it. But because having someone with having all the industry mindset and is able to connect us with people like Jason Kulik at IIC, or like with Purdue Engineering and such on, you can actually really push the barrier, like having stuff happening faster, having the means, and I'm not just talking about money, but way more about the time and the access to experts to get stuff done. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that. So our next three speakers are all from Purdue College of Engineering. And we're going to start with Professor Stephen Weirley in mechanical engineering. And what I've always found is, you know, a platform design always starts with mechanical engineering. And they're also heavily involved in the process engineering. But it's especially important when you're talking about design simplification for microfluidics, because I think we can get a little bit too complicated sometimes, and it really just takes a good mindset. So looking forward to seeing Stephen's talk.
All right, thanks for the introduction, Mike. And I guess I always agree that any project starts with mechanical engineering, but of course I'm biased. All right, I got this on the pen now. There we go. Okay. There we are. So people have been looking at flows moving for millennia, but not had the advanced tools to make anything quantitative. In particular, I saw these notebooks when I was in Italy last year. And Da Vinci was looking at flow through heart valves, which was cool. But bringing things to the more modern era, this guy that you see here, Ludwig Prandtl, he was one of the first people to do what I would call quantitative flow visualization. And you see some, these aren't his experiments, these are like the pictures that he took. And the important thing, the theme that's going to be continuing throughout my presentation is using particles as sensors. And so right now he's using these particles as passive tracers to show him where the flow is going. So 100 years passed, we made things more modern, and we do the same sort of thing though. We use particles to tell us how the flow is moving and also to use as sensors. And so here's a little schematic of a microscopic particle image velocimeter, in which we use a light source and we look into some microscopic device, and you see the little white dots. We track how particles move, take a bunch of pictures of those particles and analyze their motion using some kind of advanced algorithm. And there's a whole family of those algorithms out there. And so you can do cool things like this. I mean, this is nearly two decades old, but this is a case where you'd use the particles to do fundamental biology. And sort of this is a human red blood cell that you see in the center of the image. And we were measuring the flow around the red blood cell. And so you could imagine doing things like assessing shear stress on a cell or something like that. This one happened to be fixed on a surface, so this wasn't really useful from a biological point of view, but it just gives you the idea that with modern tools, you can measure things that we previously couldn't even see. So using particles as detectors, the particle motion will change depending on the condition of the particle, and that is, the example that you see here is we have a what I would call a large nanoparticle, 100 nanometers, and we are decorating it with smaller nanoparticles around the edge. And you can see this. This is a scanning electron micrograph, which if you were doing biological samples, you couldn't do that with the biological samples. But you see the large nanoparticle in the center, and then you see decorating around the edge these smaller nanoparticles. So effectively, you're increasing the size of the particle. And so you can measure that size change in the way that you can sense that size change in the way that the particles move. You can also change the viscosity of the fluid that the particle is in. So particles will vibrate around randomly just due to random thermal vibration called Brownian motion or diffusion. And if the liquid that the particles are in, if the liquid that the particles is in, it changes in viscosity, becomes more viscous. Think about comparing water to honey if you were trying to swim in honey or something, right? That wouldn't work. You can sense that with the particle motion. And so what you see here in the left figure is a an insulin, I would say an insulin freshness test, to be colloquial about it. And the idea is if you get your insulin delivered and dropped on your porch and it sits there over the weekend, is it still good? You know, you don't know. So I think a lot of people might, on fixed incomes, might try to determine whether it's good or not by using it and seeing if it has the usual effect. But we can measure the viscosity change with particle motion, and that's what the figure on the left we should concentrate on. That's what that shows. So the red line shows us what happens when a sample becomes more and more degraded, which in biological terms is denatured. The protein, insulin's a protein, it becomes denatured. And as it gets more and more denatured, the viscosity increases, and we can detect that using these particles. I'd like to show you the particle motion, but we're not using videos today. So what you would see if you were looking at this image is these particles sort of vibrating around in space, and the particles on the left would vibrate more than the particles on the right because the particles on the left are either smaller or they're in a lower viscosity fluid. Okay, so that was, let's say, the first thrust of what I'd like to tell you about, which is using the particles as sensors. The next thing, the next topic is using, let's call it using advanced imaging methods to measure fluid motion. So the first thing, I didn't realize this was here. You'll hear more about this from Dr. Linus, who's coming up later. We took all of this stuff that we've done with this particle motion and put it onto a portable platform, point of care diagnostics. So you'll hear more about that in a bit. Tying into the projects that Dr. Dice and Pujia described, my group did the microfluidic transport for this system. And maybe the heart of it was this off-chip peristaltic pump in which we had to control the pump to transport several different, the sample, reagent, and buffers. And to introduce them into the chip at the right time and the right quantities. I have some, I don't have really good video of that or images of that, but I'd like to tell you about a project that is similar in nature, which is transporting fluids on a chip. And what we're gonna look at is upper right here. This is the building block of an on-chip microfluidic pump. So what you're looking at is what's called a valve, right? Just a valve, an on-off valve. And the way that, what exactly you're looking at is there's a horizontal channel here that runs left to right, and it's broken. It runs into a wall at this location, and then it continues on the other side. And so in order to explain this, I need to come over on the left and look at these figures on the left. So here's that channel that moves, that goes from left to right, and here's the wall that I described. And when in the configuration that we're looking at now, the upper figure, you see the valve closed. Any fluid that's running in the channel on the left runs into a wall and can't move. But by providing a vacuum down here, some pressure to pull down this membrane, the darker blue rectangle is a membrane. We can pull that membrane down, that opens the valve. And so then the fluid is able to go from left to right through here. And so that's a valve, right? That's an important fluid device for, you know, you could think about that as a traffic light. If we arrange three of these valves in succession, so now look lower right, if we arrange three of these valves in succession, then you can do on-chip peristaltic pumping. And this is exactly the way your gut works. Or milking a cow, you're squeezing one valve and then the next. And so this is a valve. And actually, by the way, I should give you some, there's no scale on these. So this channel, this is the channel running left to right here. This channel is about 200 microns, which is about the size of two human hairs vertically. And you see the left valve open and the right two valves closed. And then what we do is in progression, we close the left valve, and open the right valves. And we basically squeeze these in succession and pump the fluid. So we can adapt or combine three valves to form an on-chip peristaltic pump. All of this stuff is made out of polydimethyl siloxane, which is PDMS, really great stuff for rapid prototyping. This is what it looks like. So these sorts of chips, these give you an idea, right? Here's a researcher's hand, right? So this gives you an idea of length scale. So the whole chip is centimeter scale. The channels, which you may or may not be able to see depending on the resolution of your screen, the channels on here, there's hundreds of channels on this chip, and each of those is, you know, on the order of a human hair. And what you see here is the spaghetti of tubing is the tubes with which you can apply pressure or vacuum, gas, using gases, to control those pumps and valves on chip. Okay, so one thing we can do when we're pumping fluids around on chip is Dr. Dice described, and that is we can break up the flow into droplets. And so what you're looking at here is a T-junction, and the T-junction has a aqueous or water-based sample coming in the vertical direction. And then it has oil that's being pumped in the horizontal direction from left to right. And what happens all automatically without me controlling it is the fluids break up into droplets, and very regular droplets. If the flow rates are constant, what happens is, you know, let's say the vertical flow gets pinched off by the horizontal flow and the oil forms a droplet, and then pressure is building up in the vertical channel, and eventually it pinches off the oil, and you get an aqueous droplet. So you end up with a chain of droplets. And so that you can use each of those droplets then as a tiny reaction well in a multi-well plate. And so what you're looking at here is creating hundreds or thousands, actually you don't see thousands, but what you're looking at here is many of those droplets. This is a serpentine channel, which you probably can't see. The problem with using PDMS is it's a bit like Wonder Woman's plane in that you can say, hey, we got some great stuff here, but the only way you can see it is by where the droplets follow, or the path the droplets follow. So anyhow, they weave back and forth and show us, you can imagine then if you were, you could do a different reaction in each of these droplets. And so you could do on-chip chemistry this way. And the fact that they, if I keep them in channels like this, they all stay in order, which means I can keep track of how long the reaction has been proceeding in each of those droplets. And to conclude, there may be one thing that's a problem in these sorts of devices is if I would like to do a reaction, let's say I want to combine this droplet with that droplet. The problem is they have oil in between them. And so I have to somehow get the oil out from in between. And that's what this shows. So over on the left here, you can see the way that you do that is you make a wide spot in the road. So if you think about the channel as a road, you think about making a wide spot in the road, then the oil can come out from in between two droplets. And again, this was also supposed to be a video, but what you'd see is a red droplet come into this wide spot, a blue droplet behind it catches up to the red droplet, and I think you can see this, is that the droplet is purple on the front end and blue on the back end because it has consumed the red droplet and has formed purple. So, you know, basic color stuff that kids do. All right, so I think that's all I had to say today, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
So I think, you know, the speed of the prototype development was really fast in our collaboration, and I wonder what your viewpoint was on, you know, what makes that go faster in terms of, you know, what key user requirements are really necessary?
Yeah, I guess maybe it's the answer to that question is maybe finding the right tool for the right job. And so we've had projects where we've spent 2 years building a chip like this. And we've had projects where we've whacked one out in an afternoon. And it all depends on tolerances and you know, the money that's available and how close we are to market. Like for instance, with the project with you guys, the Sierra particles, we were, let's say, a lot further. We wanted to be a lot closer to market at the end of the project. Right. So we had to spend quite a bit more time working on the fluid handling system there. But sometimes, you know, literally this will be an afternoon and we'll be able to, PDMS is great for pumping out devices in a hurry.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your presentation. And in the sake of time, I'd like to switch to Shreyas Sen, professor of assistant professor of electrical and computer engineering at Purdue. Clearly, that is sort of the next step in a point of care system is the electrical engineering, and it's only become more and more imperative as, you know, we move to these personal electronic devices and such a higher density of information. So please welcome Professor Sen. We can't hear you.
Thank you, Michael, for the quick introduction. After my PhD from Georgia Tech, I was at Intel Research for 4.5 years, where you know, I contributed to communication circuits, including impacting USB-C type. For last 4.5 years, I have been at Purdue, where I have been looking at communication around the human body and sensing to build very well-connected point-of-care devices and other electronic devices. So to that end, let me figure out the movement. So to that end, we all know that the wearable point of care space is increasing. There are many cool sensors that are being built. One such example is this year, in collaboration with Professor Chi-Wan Lee and with a big team from Purdue, we published in Science Advances a sensor which can detect swallowing. So this is a flexible sensor which detects the EMG, as well as there is a strain gauge which can detect strain. Our part, being an electronics design group, was this white box, which then converts this information, and as you see over here in the red, transmits it through Bluetooth. So it was very convenient for this project to carry around this device over here. But in future, as you have, as Michael pointed out, many sources of information, both in the same sensor as well as at different sensors around the body, having such a device may not be the most efficient way. So to that end, I'm here to tell you, this is the present, but the future should not look like this. In the future, we should be able to take this, miniaturize it down to a small dust-sized particle in the sensors themselves. And why we want to do that? Because at the end of the day, the adoption depends on the usability. If you have to carry five of these big boxes on your body, you're not going to use it. Second, we are going to deal with a lot of private data, including, for example, accessing our pacemaker, which needs to be very secure. People should not be able to snoop into these networks and tamper with your body. Third is, you know, we already see this fatigue of charging these electronic devices. We all have like four or five devices already. If you have five more devices on your body, are you going to take this off and charge every night? Or even like twice a day? So it needs, the ideal goal is to go towards perpetual life for these devices. It should not have harmful chemicals. And talking about today's battery, we know those have harmful chemicals. So can we get rid of battery for these kind of connected point of care devices? And eventually, all of this should lead to huge amount of health data, which multiplex from different sensors, giving very meaningful insights. So how can we get there? So in today's talk, I'll show you the biggest challenges and some significant improvements in recent times to those challenges. So if you imagine, this kind of a sensor node would have first the transducer, what I call is the material that is converting your biological signals to some kind of electrical signal. And then the circuitry. The circuitry has sensing circuitry, some kind of a computation on board, and then the communication. Now, if you try to look at the energy background between these three parts, specifically focusing on the computation and the communication, in this chart, what you see on the x-axis is number of bits switched or number of bits communicated. And on the y-axis, you see the energy. And the lower lines are basically theoretical limits in both cases, in the blue and the red. Blue being the computation energy and the red being the communication energy. And the higher lines are more practical limits. You can see more details in our paper. But you can see that typically the communication energy is four orders of magnitude higher than the computation energy. What does it tell us? It tells us if you get information, if you get data about our body on a sensor and trying to send that data, you are energy non-optimal. You should do compute on that data right at that location to extract information out of that data. Go from data domain to information domain because computation energy is so cheaper compared to communication. That's the first insight. The second insight is come up with technology which should reduce this communication energy and make it more meaningful, more comparable to the computing. It's not going to happen ever because there is the fundamental limits, but bring it down. So I'll show you efforts in both directions. So in summary, you know, the pain points in today's point of care wearable medical sensors is the biggest one is communication. Today's Bluetooth is like 10 milliwatt, and we need to get it to the microwatt range. Sensing is already almost there. You can do this, our physiological signals are generally low speed. So you can do this low speed sensing at sub tens of microwatts today, and there is already path towards going to sub microwatt. And then bringing the intelligence to go from the data domain to the information domain is what we call it in-sensor analytics or in-sensor intelligence, which then helps us send less amount of data. We just send the information, reducing the energy. So for future energy autonomous or battery-free nodes, we basically need at least 10x improvement in the communication side to make this feasible. And also we need a lot of improvement in the integration technology. Some of the technologies are already there, but we have to integrate these transducers with this maybe silicon or non-silicon integrated circuits to have a very wearable kind of a form or even implantable form factor design. So the next part of the talk, I'm going to tell you how we have addressed the biggest bottleneck in these connected wearable medical devices that take the connectivity energy from tens of milliwatts to sub-microwatt through inventions at Purdue in the last 4 years. But before I do that, let me paint a picture of how the future is going to look like. Around our body, there are going to be many consumer electronic devices, as you can see on the left, as well as many medical devices, as you can see on the right. And these devices are going to form a subset of the Internet of Things, or IoT, as we know. And they are going to have a common distinguishing feature that all of them are on or in your body. So they have a common medium that is your body. And hence, there is a new term that is emerging, Internet of Body. So these medical and consumer devices are going to be part of this network called Internet of Body, or IOB. I'm going to show you how to make it secure and efficient. The first question is, are these IOBs secure today? To understand that, let's understand what goes on. When we send something in a sensor, we typically use electromagnetic fields and radiate the signal out in all directions using an antenna. And the information goes all around us. If we for Bluetooth 30 feet, for Wi-Fi could be even more. And anybody in that vicinity can snoop your signal and can hack into this network with some hacking techniques. Imagine you are sitting in a coffee shop and trying to connect your pacemaker to your watch. The electromagnetic signal that you send out goes throughout the coffee shop, and anybody in the coffee shop has access to it, access to the physical signals. We try to encrypt this using encryption and passwords, but passwords also gets hacked, and there is a significant vulnerability because everybody has your signal. Now, this fear propelled US Vice President Dick Cheney to ask his doctors back in 2011 to stop all communication to his connected pacemaker, because he was influenced by the Broken Hearts episode of the Homeland TV series, actually in the 2012 time frame, where it was shown that somebody hacked into the vice president's pacemaker and killed him. But are these only stories? In the same time frame, a famous hacker, Barnaby Jack, actually demonstrated in front of a big audience at conferences live that he can break into connected pacemakers and insulin pumps, making this vulnerability real. And as even recently as last year, many government agencies has come out with these kind of vulnerabilities, which has led to recalls of name brand companies. What can we do about it? So, like I said, in this Internet of Body, all of these devices are on your body. And our body has a lot of water, so it's kind of conductive. So why not use the body's conductivity to use the body as a wire and send signals through it? Inject small amounts of electrical signals, which are 10,000x below the safety limits or 1,000x below the safety limits, and then pick it up other locations on the body. What happens in that case is these signals don't come outside of your body, and any nearby attacker cannot snoop these signals. Also, because the signal energy gets contained within the body, these are much more efficient, as I will show later. So we published this concept in Nature Scientific Reports last year, where you can see the lady on the right using a Bluetooth. Her signals goes up to actually much more than 5 meters, up to 30 feet. Whereas the boy on the left is connecting his watch to pacemaker using the body as a wire, and the signals cannot be picked up any more than 1 centimeter off of the body surface in these frequencies. This opens up a new field of connectivity for wearable devices. And let me try to paint from a very high level why that is possible. On the x-axis, what you see is frequency. So this is a megahertz range and this is gigahertz range. And this is today's systems. On the gigahertz range, 2.4 gigahertz, as you might know, is Bluetooth. We use this electromagnetic spectrum. And with today's technology at lower frequencies, which is called the electroquasi-statics, the signal is very low, so it is not usable. Using our patented technology, we have come up with a technique such that the loss in these low frequencies have improved by 100x, making it usable for the first time. Now, you can use this physically secure range, or in other words, body as a wear, to do a lot of connectivity around the body, both securely as well as efficiently. We demonstrated this with an integrated circuit that we built. So you can see the size of the integrated circuit, it's like tiny. And that's the world's lowest energy body area network, or IOB IC. We benchmarked it as a function of data rate and total power. You can see compared to the wireless body area network like Bluetooth, this is 100x lower energy. And compared to other state of the art, it is 18x lower energy. But for that was a higher speed system. For the physiological signal monitoring or wearable point of care, we don't necessarily need that high speeds. So we built a second chip just this year, where we have demonstrated this is Bluetooth in the milliwatt range, previous work in 40 microwatt range, and we have only 415 nanowatt. So this is the first sub-microwatt communication for wearable devices around the body, which now means you can harvest energy in the level of, from even movement, microwatts. So your communication can be battery free, which was never possible before. So this fact that electroquasi-static human body communication is physically secure was widely picked up by the news sites. As you can see here, somebody said scientists design a network that lives inside your body. Others mentioned that it demonstrates a huge leap in medical data security, which may affect many bioelectronic medicine for years to come. This was recognized by the MIT Tier 35 India Award, as well as CNBC TV interviews and a TEDx talk in Indianapolis last year. So we have demonstrated these devices that it works. And last year, like I pointed out, US Department of Homeland Security had come up with a vulnerability in the radio communication for the security reasons I mentioned. And following that, IEEE Spectrum basically pointed out that, oh, these vulnerabilities exist for medical device communication. And there is this new technology from Purdue using the body as a wire. Why not just use that? So I want to leave you with that question, that while the devices are on your body, why not use the body as the communication medium to get much more security and efficiency to change our wearable point of care connectivity? I'll stop here.
Thank you. I find this deeply fascinating because, we were promised as a society to control our electronic and medical records. And today, it's everybody and their brother has a business that's controlling our access to data. Our data is not being used. And there's many papers that show if they just looked at the data that they already collected, it would help our health outcomes. So the idea that the body could, individually store our complete medical data record is amazing. So I guess my question to you is, the barriers to entry. When you're going to this kind of scale of changing the paradigm, you've got a lot of people that don't want to see a change.
Yeah, so the change will be slow, as in any technology, and we have to find early adopters. And the early medical space may or may not be the early adopters because medical space needs longer time frame. It can be used for other applications, like opening doors, which could be a completely different application of this technology to start the adoption. And then as people see the benefit and it works, I hope in future, and I'll dedicate my life toward that, that it changes the paradigm of body area network connectivity for even medical devices.
Thank you, and I'm sorry we went over a little bit to for our next speaker, who is Professor Jacqueline Linus. She's an assistant professor in biomedical engineering, and I think the reason I'm most excited to hear her talk is I think she shares really that aspiration that a lot of us in the point of care field have. You know, to test the world and, you know, provide more actionable results and information to people. And so I welcome her talk now.
Thank you. It's really an honor to be here. I really appreciate this opportunity. And I'm going to tell you about a couple of the projects in my lab. We do, I'm going to go back a second, quite a bit of work focusing on paper-based devices and on microfluidics for point of care technologies that can be used anywhere in the world, mostly around infectious diseases, but also we have some projects in non-invasive sample collection from exhaled breath so that we could monitor glucose or maybe COVID-19. And another project around wearable devices where we're working with people who are interested in opioids overdose detection. And so it's actually been really an honor to work with all three of our other speakers today, Frederic and Shreyas and Steve, on various projects in the lab. And I'm going to talk only about the two focused very specifically on diagnostics. The first being the particle diffusometry that Dr. Worley had mentioned, where we are focused on leveraging this for detecting pathogens in this case, cholera detection in a water sample, so that you could take this device out to, let's see, we've brought it to Haiti, to Bangladesh, to Kenya, anywhere that there could be a potential epidemic of cholera, where you could test the water samples and detect whether it's there based on capturing the pathogens and then lysing the bacteria in this case, amplifying the DNA, and then detecting the long chains of DNA that are made using particle diffusometry, where if the sample is there, then it gets very viscous and you can see a slowdown. And so a lot has gone into the background to that, but for the user, you simply collect a sample, heated on a chip, and then we're actually getting rid of the add the particles separate, that's incorporated into the chip, and then image that on the phone using that particle diffusometry that Steve had mentioned. And like I said, typically you would capture and amplify the DNA, and that would be monitored using fluorescence, but because we make these really long strands, we can use particle diffusometry here. And because the videos don't work, they look very similar. But as Steve said, low diffusivity here would, I'm going to see if I can get the little pointer to work too. Low diffusivity would allow us, the particles would move very slowly, and high diffusivity, they move much more quickly. And all of this works on the smartphone. My lab has collaborated very closely with Steve on the hardware side of this, where we have made our own little microscope, which is a laser pointer, now an actual slightly higher powered laser, and some theater film and a tiny little grain of sand size ball that sits in there to magnify the particles. So that you can see these 400 nanometer particles on the phone itself. And then over here's a little heater. In this older prototype, that's a paperclip, but it's gotten a little fancier now, but we put it together to make it work initially. And we've started a company, OmniViz, that's actually translating this technology and making it robust so that it can work out in the field. And my lab's focus mainly on this test chip side of things and the biologic portion, as we're working to get the assays robust and specific and sensitive so that we don't have any detection of non-pathogen samples, because there is a Vibrio species that are, Vibrio cholera is one of them, that are non-pathogenic in the environment, and they're not going to cause a horrible diarrheal disease, and we don't want to accidentally detect those, so we focus on that toxin gene itself. And let's see, we're stuck. There we go. And it has been a large collaboration to get this off the ground. I've worked on the nucleic acid amplification assay. Steve, the microfluidics, Dr. Tamara Kinzer-Ursum, the actual nanoparticle conjugation, and she and Steve developed the particle diffusometry along with, on the other side of the circle, Dr. Catherine Clayton, who's the CEO of OmniViz, and is really passionate about bringing things out of the lab. This project has really grown, and so now we've got collaborators, not just on, you know, can we get a technology piece to work, but is it going to be usable, and what do people actually need to use it for? Dr. Ronald Tanui, who's at Moi University in Kenya, and they're actually using this, and I realize that's not the right picture there, but it is a smartphone device. As Frederic had mentioned, it really is the students involved that do most of the actual work in the lab, but we all get to take the credit. But without the students doing the work, it wouldn't really never be able to get done. So we need to keep them in mind as well. The another project that we're working on is this paper-based device. And this, our goal is to combine the simplicity of a lot of those paper tests that you hear about for example, COVID-19, or essentially these are pregnancy test style assays. They're an immunoassay. And we want to combine those with the accuracy of lab-based nucleic acid diagnostics, because those are the gold standard in many cases. So our goal is to amplify to capture the bacteria or the virus, amplify the DNA and the RNA, and then read out just like these protein assays, where you have one line for a negative sample and two lines for a positive sample, to show that you can see all of these complicated things that the user doesn't have to know anything about. So here is a concept of a sample separation membrane. We started with HIV. So in this case, we would separate blood from the virus and the plasma, and then move that downstream to lyse and amplify, reverse transcribe the RNA to DNA, amplify that, and then move that again further downstream to the detection zone. We are controlling this with wax valves, because wax is convenient and melts on demand, and then the liquid can push past that valve in order to move to the next zone. And come on, little buddy. This is a smartphone powered prototype of that device, and I've got it sitting here. So it's about the size of a digital pregnancy test, and we were able to put those valves in different zones, and the reaction zones and the separation zones. It happens to be powered by a smartphone because we need the battery off of it, but it you can imagine, and I would like to take this forward so that we're actually leveraging the power of the smartphone, similar to the OmniViz project, where you have that computational aspect and you have the connectivity aspect, which are really critical in moving forward with not just detecting something, but then connecting people up to care for the next steps of what do you need to do next. And so for the user, as I mentioned, it's very simple. You add a sample of blood and some wash buffer behind it. You fold it up. As soon as you plug it in, it starts to heat. And then it does that heating and walking through each of the steps, depending on the pathogen that we're looking at, that takes 30 to 90 minutes. And then you can read out positive, two lines yes, one line no. Uh, we, as I mentioned, we show this for HIV detection in blood. And one of the things that we have been focusing on my lab is the usability. And so on the right side, we quantified the line intensity. And we also looked at what line intensity can somebody see if they're in the sunlight, if they're under in the shade, if they're indoors, because you don't want to have this again resulted from a lot of collaboration. In order to be able to do the heating on chip, we worked with Dr. Leah Stancia's lab that has really thin film heaters that use low power printed silver ink. We've been starting up reagent storage in collaboration with the Lyo Hub here at Purdue, and Alina Alexenko and Liz Topp are leading that. We took this device to Kenya, and Professor Eddie Odari has been testing that out. And again, Natalia Rodriguez on our user-centered design side of things, we've got a new project moving forward. And then what's really critical is not just can we make this device in the lab one at a time or a few at a time, but can we make it a scalable device? And so Purdue's got a reel-to-reel manufacturing center, and we've initially started working with Dr. George Chu on how can we put in the proper controls in the process of designing this and manufacturing it so that we have the reliability that we need to produce hundreds of thousands or millions of these devices.
Thank you. So I guess we did pretty good. We're 1 minute over all. So I'm gonna forego any further questions on processes and stuff, if you don't mind, and allow Joe Beth to take over at this point.
Great. Thank you so much to all of our panelists today. And I think we had a great first virtual frameworks. I want to again thank our sponsors, Indiana Biosciences Research Institute, for helping us put this on, and Dr. Pooja for putting this great group together. All great information and exciting work being done here in the Indiana Life Sciences community. I also want to thank our sponsor, Indy Science Connect, for helping us get the word out. We will be having more of these moving forward and throughout the year. So you can go to our website, biocrossroads.com, to sign up for a newsletter if you aren't already receiving notifications, or you could follow us on Twitter if you'd like to know about more of these virtual frameworks. And with that, we'd like to thank everybody for coming and have a wonderful day. Thank you.
Okay. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.